Accession number 27058, Reel 3.
This is the second reel of a taped interview with Robert Ulrich in his home in Perth, Western Australia. On the 17th of the 12th, 2003, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Robert, you were talking about Alexandria. I wanted us to stay in Alexandria for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us what it was like being an airman in Alexandria.
Well, it was quite strange to be in the sinful Far East and all these beautiful damsels wandering all over the place. And
was it really that sinful?
Oh, yes. Oh, if you search for it, it was. Or if you were lucky, it was. But I came across one young lady. When we were told that 8 of us were due for leave, I forget, we were past Tobruk somewhere, and the only aircraft they could give us was an old DC-3, which was one of the workhorses of the RAF. I think they were designed in about 1930. Very, very reliable, but fairly slow. It's about 140 miles an hour. And of course they were transport aircraft, so they had no seats in them. And there was not even a toilet, or not even ye old galvanised iron bucket. And we had to land every 2 or 3 hours to refuel and attend to toilet facilities. And I thought, well, good heavens above, what I've got to do when I get to Alex is buy a book to read on the way back. So we booked in at what was called the Cecil Hotel, which in those days was probably the very best hotel in Alexandria, right on the waterfront. You looked out over the bay, beautiful view. And after we'd had breakfast the next day, I said to Franco, who was our maitre d', I want to buy a book. Where's the best shop to go, Franco? And he said, the Victoria Bookshop in Ruzagul, just around the corner next to Seychelles. And Seychelles was the big Meyer-type store. So I wandered around and found the Victoria Bookshop, wandered in. And I was looking at the books and the titles and so on and so on. And a little voice said, can I help you? I turned around and there was no one there. So I looked down and there was a tiny little girl next to me. She was like a little doll. And I said, yes, I'm looking for a book. And she said, well, what do you want, adventure or romance? I said, just something to read on an 8-hour plane trip home. And she finally sold me one by a fellow called Dennis Wheatley, a thing called The Sword of Fate, which is an adventure story, which is quite good. So I buzzed off, and after I thought, well, she's a very nice young lady, I'll wander back. So I wandered back and said, could you join for a cup of coffee? And she said, oh, a cup of coffee, I suppose that'll be all right. I said, well, you suppose what'll be all right? She said, well, you're a soldier, and you're an Australian. And my grandpa tells me what the Australians did in the First World War, and everyone's a bit careful about you Australians. I said, well, you don't believe all you hear. Well, I'm talking about a cup of coffee. So we went to a little shop around the corner and had some sort of a cream cap and a cup of coffee. And I asked if she'd go out one evening. She said, oh, I'd like to, very much I would, but my mum wouldn't let me. I said, what do you mean your mum wouldn't let you? She said, I've told you before, you're an Australian and you're a soldier. And I said, well, I'm going to sort this out very quickly. And she says, ha ha, oh yeah. You're going to tell me how you're going to weave this bit of magic you were talking about? I said, yep, very simple. I'm going to go and see your mum. And she said, what? I said, I'm going to go and see your mum. So she told me where she lives, in a huge block of apartments at a place called Sporting Club, which was a huge sporting arena a few miles to the east of Alex. 10 minutes tram ride. And this place had horse racing tracks, cycle racing tracks, tennis courts, squash court, billiard rooms, anything. It was a total sporting complex of many acres, and there were 2 huge apartment blocks, and she lived in one. So I wandered up, knocked on the front door, and a very, very, very elderly gentleman came to the door, very tall, and in his pajamas. And he looked at me and said, yes, young man. And I said, good evening. I wonder if I could have a word with Mr. Enido Itakis, please. And he looked at me as though I'd made a totally improper suggestion to him. And he looked at his watch and he said, do you wish to speak to my daughter Irini at this hour? It was 8:10 on Friday night. I said, yep, that's what I'm here for. So he said, oh, come in, come in, come in. So I went in, and I'd forgotten in my anxiety to get to where they lived. Mrs. Noitakis couldn't speak one word of English. But Popper worked for a British Army unit somewhere. He was quite a nice old chap, and he produced several bottles of something to drink, which we drank. And I stayed there for about an hour, and I buzzed off, and he took me at the door and said, thank you for coming to visit us. I'm very pleased to have met you. I said, goodbye, Mr. Noitakis, off I buzzed. Having had breakfast the following morning, I trotted round to the Victoria bookshop, and Irini, when she saw me, she jumped up and down and clapped her hands and said, it worked, it worked, it worked. We're allowed to go out together. And I didn't realise at that stage what a great social concession that was. He was a little Greek girl, not yet 17, and I was a complete stranger. I was in the Air Force and I was an Australian. But anyway, we went out for years and years and years, and we wrote for years and years and years after the war. But after many years, I got a very short note to say, won't be able to write after this. Getting married Saturday morning. Thanks for all the memories. Love her, Eddie. So I'd love to know where she is, but that was years ago. But one day she said to me, I want to give you a little present. I said, oh, yes. And she gave me a beautiful crucifix about that big, solid silver, the arms, the diameter of a pencil, and each end of the crucifix had a band of gold on it, and there was a figurine of Christ on the crucifix, which was in gold, which was obviously worth a great deal of money. And she made me promise, hand on heart stuff, that every time I flew, I'd carry that with me, which I did. And at the end of the war, when I was coming home, I gave it back to them. I said, yeah, it's obviously a family heirloom, and I wouldn't want to take it home. And well, your property, thanks very much for the loan. You see how well it worked, here I am. So that was there, and we finished our leave and went back.
Was it... people often say that it wasn't sensible to try and form relationships with the opposite sex during wartime. Was that something that you ever thought of?
Oh, as far as getting married, I would never have got married during wartime, because I thought if you let your romantic feelings get away from you, and you happen to leave your young wife very pregnant, then you're shot up the backside by a German fighter pilot the next day. It's going to leave her in rather a mess. Because my family were working class, we had no money, and her family, I don't think, were very flush with cash. So it would have left her in a hell of a situation with an Australian child, no Australian husband, and where would the money come from to look after the child? Now, I would never have got married during the war.
My impression, though, is that it was a risky thing to get too emotionally attached at all during a wartime situation.
Yes, I know some chaps who did get married during the war, and most of the marriages seemed to fail a few years after the war had ended. But I suppose if you're dealing with a different race, different culture, different religion, different everything, there's a hell of a risk involved in that. But Irini was what they call Orthodox Greek, which I believe is very close to our Church of England. So there was no dispute between Irini about anything. In fact, when I came home after the war, I had some wonderful glamour photographs of Irini, which I showed my mother and my stepfather. My stepfather in those days was a governor chap. And he was a very quiet man, and he said to me one evening out of the blue, if you'd like to bring your little Greek girlfriend out here for a holiday, ask her out. She can stay with us as long as she likes. We have a very nice home in Shenzhen Park, which is just over there. And he said, as I'm a government waller, if there's any problems with immigration or anything else, I can help sort it out. So I wrote to Edie and told her, and she wrote back within almost a day and said, I'd like nothing better to see where you live and to meet your mother, but Mum won't let me come. And Greek mothers are an unbelievable authority over the family. And I really believe then, and I still think it's so now, that Mrs. Noritakis wouldn't want Irini to come out here, because if Irini had come and been away from mother's authority, she was then about 19, this was the end of the war, 19 and a half perhaps, and she'd been under her mother's influence and control for 19 and a half years. If she came out here and saw the free and easy life, if there was any thought of any matrimony going on, she might have been quite happy to say he'll not go back to Alexandria. And one thing I'm sure about, my mother was a person of great determination. And if she had ever seen Irini, and I tell you she was unbelievably beautiful, Irini would never have been allowed to leave Australia ever again. I think if you marry into a different culture, different religion, there's always a risk of something, I think.
In relation to Alexandria,
yep.
The adventure, my impression is it wasn't a particularly warlike situation.
Well, not in Alex or Cairo, they're both protected cities. Although Mussolini did arrive just before the Battle of Alamein, complete with a huge white stallion. He landed at a place called Marble Arch, which is a huge airfield a few miles to the west of Alex, about 200 miles west of Alex, I think. And the idea was that Mussolini was going to ride through in the triumphal march, entering Alexandria with this huge white stallion, but unfortunately his opportunity never arose.
But the general situation on your arrival doesn't paint the picture of great concern of you entering a war zone, for instance.
Well, no, but I'm a bit of a fatalist. I believe if you're going to go, you're going to go, no matter where you are. And I hadn't got to the war zone. I was on a squadron, but when you get to a squadron, it's quite an unreal existence for a few weeks. Because nobody knows you, and no one knows what you can do, or what you will do, or what you won't do if something happens. Because in a week's time, one of those fellows flying next to me might find himself in trouble, and the only bloke to give him a hand is me. And if I haven't got the courage or the skills, then he might suffer. So they won't even talk to you until you've done a few trips, and they make up their own mind whether you've got enough gumption to do the job you're there to do. It's quite unreal. They just won't even talk to you at all. But once they start and chat to you, you realise that you've been accepted into the squadron. But that might take 3 or 4 weeks. When they take a new chum on his first trip, and a trip in a fighter squadron is called an operation. That means you're fighting the enemy. They have a formation of 1, 2, 3 going that way, and the bloke in the middle is the leader, and he flies on a perfectly straight course. Then they have 1, 2, 3 behind their number twos, and that's where they put you, right in the middle. So it's a safer spot, because if there's an attack made, they very rarely go for number twos. They always try and get the number ones, because they're the most experienced bloke. But you might do 2, 3, or 4 trips as a number two before they think you've developed enough idea to what goes on to cope with anything, because we were once told by a doctor that the biggest problem with new pilots was a situation called being flight blind. According to him, you might see something visually by looking at it, but it doesn't get into the memory box in the brain, and while you actually see it, you don't recall what it's there for. And that's called being flight blind. It's also being called pretty bloody dumb, but you get over that quite quickly. But they only ever take one new chum at a time. And once they start saying good day to you at breakfast and pass the salt or give me the tomato sauce, you've been accepted.
So let's talk about the early period when you first got there. What was it like?
Well, it was very frenetic, actually, because we were just in time for the Battle of El Alamein, which was quite a bit of a stoush. General Montgomery had just been appointed in charge of the 8th Army, and he had lots of rules and things. And the story was that there were 1,100 guns which stretched for I forget how many miles, and each gun was about 30 yards apart. And there were 5-inch field guns, quite large pieces of ordnance, really. And they had one of these guns right outside our tent. And of course, none of us in the tent had ever heard a shot fired, ever. And we knew that when it fired, it was going to be a loud bang. But what we didn't understand was that what would happen to our tent because of the huge air disturbance and this bloody great shell whistling out of this bloody muzzle every 2 or 3 minutes. And these English blokes used to practice there almost 24 hours a day. Dummy ammunition, of course. They used projectiles with the same shape and the same weight as their actual shell, so they'd get used to shoving them up into the breach. And the Battle of El Alamein started at 21:40 hours on the 23rd of October 1942.
Prior to that, obviously you'd been there about a month prior to that actual event. What was life like then, building up to that?
Well, no one wants to know you. All they do is they say, oh, aircraft number 23 wants a check. I'll send one of the new blokes. And it's not like you see in the movies with Errol Flynn or John Wayne screaming down into power dives. Somebody might come back and say, oi, my oil temperature's not reading right, it's too low. So they'll give it to the mechanics and they'll adjust the oil temperature, whatever the current complaint is. Then somebody will take 23 for a test run, 45 minutes, keep your eye on the oil gauge. So all you do is take off and fly around for 20 minutes behind the fuel gauge or whatever you're looking at. And it gives the right read and you come back and sign that it's okay. So that's all you do. And you eat.
What do you eat? What were you eating? What was the food like?
Well, pretty terrible actually. I'll tell you a funny story about the food in a minute. I suppose it was as nutritious as it could be. But of course, we didn't take the trouble to realise what logistical problems there were in getting it from point of manufacture to the point of consumption, which was one third of the way around the world. And that takes a little time. Then they've got to get it to each squadron. And we just had a new doctor, Dr. Jenkins, who was quite a nice bloke, but he was a funny bloke in a way, very good bloke. I was with a friend, a fellow called Ted Hankey. I just got a card from him yesterday. And the doctors have just told him he's got about a year to live. He's had terrible bloody medical problems the last few years. Well, I was the youngest bloke in the squadron. Ted was next to me. He was about a year older than me. And we were both bloody skinny blokes. He wouldn't want to get that thick all the way up. And I said to Ted one day, I'm getting bloody sick of this food, Hankey. Ted says, so am I, it's bloody awful. Everything we ate came out of a tin, and I don't think our cooks were particularly brilliant. I don't think the cooking apparatus they used was particularly modern or up to date. It was probably the best that was available.
You were to go and see your commanding officer or your medical officer sorted out. You're mentioning that last week.
So I said to Ted, well, let's go and see the doc. We'll have a talk. And Hank said, right, we'll go and see him.
So you'd spoken about that story. In relation to the meals, where were you to have them? What was the canteen like?
Well, on 3 Squadron, it was a little bit unusual, which was something developed by a bloke called Peter Jeffries, who unfortunately is dead now. Peter Jeffries was a man with brilliant ideas. And normally, in a squadron, you have the officer's mess and the sergeant's mess and the airman's mess. And you eat according to your rank. But Peter Jeffries said, no, not having any of that rubbish. All pilots are doing the dame block. We're going to have a pilot's mess. So all the sergeants ate in the officers' mess. It just became known as the pilots' mess. We only had tin plates and the roughest of cutlery, and that's about all there was. And everything we ate came out of a tin somewhere. If you ever got fried chicken, it came out of a tin, and it wasn't all that good. But again, there were great difficulties in providing it. But I don't know of anyone who ever died from malnutrition. But I think it was fairly habit-forming to whinge about the food.
What about the conditions in which you were living? The weather?
Unbearably hot in the day and freezing at night. And of course, the only three people who had electric light in their tent was the CO, the flight commander, and the doctor. And everybody else had to have small hurricane lamps, which you used to buy from Woolworths, for about 2 and 6 pence. And if you got in sweet with somebody from the fuel stores, they'd give you enough kerosene to keep the lamp going for so and so. But that's all there was. There was no electric light. And at night, it was just a feeble glow. They weren't able to write letters by that sort of candlelight at all.
Were you impatient? Were you hoping to get involved in proper operations?
Yep. The queen, the sooner the better. I started off, I think, about the second week of the Battle of El Alamein, but we lost a few blokes initially.
What was prior to the start, what was the general feeling towards the Germans in relation to the situation? They'd been turned back by Montgomery in the Battle of Alon Halfa on September 2nd, 42. The Battle of Stalingrad had occurred.
Oh, I think we remember that. But what we were aware of, that we were facing the, what do they call them, the Afrika Corps, or the Afrika Corps, as they call themselves. And they were very, very bloody first-class German troops. They were very good indeed. And their equipment was marvellous, absolutely marvellous. Everything they had that I saw was better than we had. The English, for instance, still had the old 303 Lee Enfield rifle that saw the light of day in the First World War. They were fairly accurate rifle, but they were bloody heavy. Oh, they were terrible heavy. The German had a Mauser, which was quite light compared to ours, and so unbelievably accurate you wouldn't believe it. And the Germans also had another one, which was everyone's aim to get hold of one. I got a couple, but I lost them when the aircraft were shot down. They were called a Schmeisser, which wasn't a large weapon at all. It was an automatic submachine gun. It only had a barrel about that long, but God, accurate. They said with a Schmeisser, if you could see something, you could hit it. That wasn't too far wrong. 9mm, and they had a trigger with a button above it. And if you pressed the button above and held the trigger back, it was automatic. If you pressed the button again, it was a single shot. But so accurate and so light.
The barrel was about, what, 18 inches?
Yep, that's all. Quite light. You could stuff it under your arm and walk for miles. Beautiful weapon. And of course, the British had two pistols, the Smith & Wesson, which was 38 caliber, the one that I saw, and that enormous Webley, which weighs about 4 pounds, is a 45 caliber, but it's about that long. It's a huge pistol. If he hits somebody, they stay hit, but the trouble is hitting anybody, because for some reason I was never good with a pistol. But the Germans had a Luger or a Walther, and they were marvellous pistols, absolutely wonderful. I pinched a Luger from somewhere, can't remember where, and I used to wear that. We had to wear some sort of sidearm when you were flying, so if you were shot down, you had at least some sort of chance of defending yourself. And we had a wing commander on our group called Billy Burton, with whom I got very friendly, because he said to me, I'd like you to fly number two to me, Robert. All right, you? I said, yes, certainly, sir. Sergeants don't argue too much with wing commanders, but it's got the bloody sense. But he was a nice bloke, Billy Burton. And he saw me one day and said, where the hell did you get that? And I said, oh, I forget where. He said, take her off, you stupid bastard. If you shot down the German sea with that, they'll blow your head off. And he said, go and get a Smith & Wesson or a Webley. I don't like them. He said, well, if they catch you with that, you're dead. Because they'll kill you, first of all, because your name will make them angry. And if you're carrying one of their own weapons against them, you won't last 5 minutes. Get rid of it. Oh, yes, sir.
Let's talk about that. Mm. We've spoken about your name, and you mentioned off-air a story that you wanted to talk, tell. Ulrich, where does that come from? You mentioned
German.
Bavaria,
I think. I think it's Bavaria. When the name came up, I was doing my final flying training. When you do your flying training, it's divided into two parts. The first one is called initial flying training, when you start off with the old Tiger Moth, which was a lovely little aeroplane. They walk you around the aeroplane and wiggle the ailerons and the elevators and the rudder bar, and they show you what you've got to do and how you move so-and-so with the control column or the rudder bar and so on. Then you do that training up for about 6 weeks, I think we did ours. Not everybody passes the elementary training because of what people call lack of coordination. And coordination was described to me by a doctor as the ability for the brain to control the eyes, the hands and the feet to all move simultaneously in different directions to achieve a certain direction of the aeroplane. And quite a few people fail. So once you do that, that's your early flying done. Then the next part of the flying training is called advanced flying training, and then they have to teach you entirely differently to use the aeroplane as a weapon of war for which it was not originally designed. And it's quite different. When you're taught to fly, it's impressed on you to be smooth, precise, and what's the other word? Oh, I can't be accurate, that's right. Good one. But of course, that's fatal if you try and do that under operation, because if some smart bastard's right behind you and you're trying to do a slow roll or a loop, he's just going to wait to the right precise moment and go bang, bang, and blow you to smithereens. So you've got to learn to fly all over the place. It's called weaving. If you want to get from there to there, you don't go in a straight line, you're all the way, just like that. Because that gives you a chance to look behind you, because if you're going to get into trouble, the chances are it'll come from behind you. So that's what you've got to look at. So this bloke, CO, sat for me, and he said, I see you've posted a 3 Squadron. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, how do you feel about that? And I said, well, you know, little skinny Bobby Ollie from Beaconsfield in Fremantle, I'm pretty pleased. He said, thought about your name? And I thought, what's this bloke on about? And I said, no. And he said, well, it's German. They're not going to like you. People do get shot down. And if you go down, you'll have your dog tags on. And once they find out who you are, they're just going to blow your head off, because they will see you as one of their own who's turned against them. And that'll give you the only excuse they need to kill you. And you'll be dead in 10 seconds. And what I can do for you, I can get your overseas posting, where you'll be dealing with the Germans, cancelled, and I can transfer your posting up the islands with the Japanese. And I thought, oh, the islands with the Japanese, oh, it doesn't sound too hot. And I said, can I have a little time to think about it? He said, yeah, but don't make up your mind halfway across the Indian Ocean, and my jurisdiction doesn't go that far. Tomorrow morning, good, come and see me about 9:30. So I thought about it all night. Went back and said, if I don't mind, sir, I'd like to leave things just as they are. It suits me quite well. He said, well, it's up to you, but I'll change you if you want to. No thanks, sir. I'd like to go. Okay, good. And he was an ex-CO of 3 Squadron, one of the first. He was probably one of the first real aces of the Australian Air Force. Everyone who flew in those days knew Peter Jeffrey, Wolf Arthur, who only died recently. Wolf Arthur, fantastic man. He married a little Armenian girl in Alexandra who came out here. Wolf only died about 2 or 3 months ago, developed Alzheimer's, and he was one of the great pilots, one of the great aces of the war too. Fantastic bloke, Wolf. Anything there that Wolf aimed at, he hit.